Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. A lesson in civic engagement this hour, from Twitter activism in the Asian American community to a pivotal vote cast by Turkey citizens after Prime Minister Erdogan tried to eradicate Twitter in that country, and a look at what happens when the democratic process fails to responsibly handle debt. Former Houston Mayor Bill White says we're borrowing for all the wrong reasons and that the consequences may be dire. But first, today's the day, March 31st, the deadline for most Americans to sign up for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. The White House reports that 6 million people have signed up for coverage so far, but some of the most important groups for the ACA to get on board have been minorities. Have they done so? And if today was the last day to make that push happen, it remains to be seen whether the Department of Health and Human Services is ready for a flood of last-minute applicants. Myra Alvarez, Associate Director of the Office of Minority Health at HHS, spoke to me earlier just as officials were trying to get the site back online after a website crash.
Actually, it's just a software bug that our team is working to correct as quickly as possible. We know that folks are looking forward to finishing their enrollment process or to get that process started, and we are ready to handle unprecedented consumer demand. But right now, they have identified the root cause of the problem and are trying to fix that software bug as quickly as possible.
And a software bug on probably the busiest traffic day of the entire campaign.
Yeah, it's true, it is. But fortunately, what we do know is that for those that have started the process, what we're offering them is a special enrollment period, and that means that they can finish that process at a different time. What matters is that we know people are interested. We know that there's consumer demand, and we're going to make that process available so that people that want the security and peace of mind that comes with health insurance have the opportunity to get it.
So we heard last week that part of the deadline was being extended for people who are in line by the time the deadline passes tonight. Does that include somebody who goes on the website today, leaves their email address? Are they in line now so that if the clock runs out tonight, they can still sign up for health care on the exchange tomorrow or the next day or up until April 7th?
So just one point of clarification. We didn't extend the open enrollment period. The open enrollment period does end today, March 31st. What we did was offer folks that are in line, that have tried to enroll in coverage and, for example, have had a technical glitch or some sort of natural circumstance has blocked them from having to finish that process, things that are out of their hands has prevented them from finishing the application process. Those individuals are going to qualify for a special enrollment period so that they can finish the process and get the health insurance they want.
Yes, and what I was wondering is if someone who leaves their email address this morning, for instance, because the website has a software bug at this very moment, qualifies to be in line, as you say, to register later.
Yes, absolutely, because consumers that are actually trying to enroll this morning, for example, they're able to leave their email, and they'll be invited back when that system is available, because we don't anticipate this problem to last all day. It was identified around 3 in the morning, and what we're trying to do is fix it as quickly as possible so that those consumers that are interested in finishing that process can do so today.
Okay, now taking a bit of a step back, Maya Alvarez, you are Associate Director of the Office of Minority Health. The rate of non-insurance or lack of insurance among Hispanics and African Americans is quite a bit higher than among the white population. And so it was sort of a special project of the first round of the Affordable Care Act to try to get a lot of minority folks who lacked insurance signed up. And I want to go through some of the numbers about how well that has worked.
Sure. As of right now, we know that people of color, communities of color, minority communities are disproportionately uninsured. For example, for Latinos, 1 out of 4 eligible Americans come from the Latino community. So we know that access to health insurance is particularly important for this disproportionately uninsured population. But we also know that for many racial and ethnic minority populations, enrolling with someone walking you through the process, answering your questions, especially someone who you know and are familiar with from your community, is particularly important. So we've been able to offer that from the very beginning, thanks to not only our work, but the work of our state and local community partners across the country.
And what kind of results have you seen? I mean, one of the phenomena that we're seeing, which maybe isn't so surprising because the Affordable Care Act does have somewhat of a patchwork. Some states have their own exchanges. Mm-hmm. Many states don't. So some states have a disproportionate amount of signups. California has a ton. Other states have barely any, like Texas, where there are a lot of Hispanic people. So what numbers have you seen in terms of minority signup as we get to the end of the first open enrollment here? What proportions are you seeing of people who didn't have insurance who now have it?
It's a great question, Todd. And unfortunately, the application on healthcare.gov or through the health insurance marketplace doesn't require the consumer to put their race and ethnicity. It's completely voluntary to submit that information. So right now, what we're trying to do is sort the information that's been submitted via the applications to ensure that what we're reporting to the public accurately reflects the diversity of the applicant pool.
The sign up on healthcare.gov doesn't have any questions on race and ethnicity. I guess there's an option, is there not, in other forms of interaction with the government? I'm not sure if on tax forms, certainly in the census, but that's only every 10 years. And it makes me wonder how you're going to track your success. Is it going to be in post hoc surveys going around and asking people, are you Hispanic? Did you sign up for insurance? How's it going to work?
So it is part of the application, except it's an optional part of the application as you move forward throughout the healthcare.gov application or through the health insurance marketplace. But like you said, we are expecting to try and find out what are our outcomes when it comes to these populations. So not only will we verify the data that does get collected voluntarily, but also working with health insurance companies themselves in the future, as well as other surveys conducted by the federal government to determine what is the race and ethnicity of the population that has acquired coverage through the marketplace.
So Myra Alvarez from the Office of Minority Health at HHS, before I let you go, I'm interested in how you view the long-term project here. We in the media, myself included, everybody's obsessed with the number 7 million if you're going to get there, and that's a good news story. But this is really a long-term project about how many Americans get insured and whether the new system envisioned by Obamacare is sustainable. And I want to know, sort of as a person who works on this every day, how you're viewing the long-term project when you have a patchwork. You have so many states that aren't expanding Medicaid, so many others that aren't running exchanges of their own. How do you view the long-term effort here?
It's a great question. Health insurance is a tool in ensuring that we can lead healthier lives. With millions, tens of millions of people in this country that don't have access to health insurance, that means they're putting off those checkups that could identify illness early. That means they're using the emergency room for routine care, driving up taxpayer dollars for everyone. When it comes to health insurance, it's an opportunity to really put our country on a trajectory towards a healthier America. And I think you're right. You know, this variety of how different states are operating marketplaces will evolve over time. I think states are looking at other states that have taken on the responsibility themselves and are looking at what lessons have we learned in the approach moving forward. And as we do move forward, we'll see that more states will want to take on this responsibility themselves. For the Medicaid program, we're already seeing that. We've got 27 states and D.C. that have chosen to expand Medicaid. Just last week, New Hampshire took on the expansion of Medicaid for their constituents. They see the benefits, not only financially with the federal government providing most of the funds for this newly expanded population, but frankly, the responsibility we have to protect the most vulnerable among us. And that's what we do with Medicaid, and then that's what we're doing with the health insurance marketplace generally. Because remember, the Affordable Care Act isn't just about the uninsured. It's about all of us. For those of us that have private insurance, we now don't have to pay co-pays or other cost-sharing requirements for preventive services like checkups, a mammogram, a colorectal screening, cancer screening test. Those of us that have insurance, we don't have to worry about lifetime limits. So if, God forbid, we have a serious car accident or a serious diagnosis and we have millions of dollars of treatment, our insurance isn't going to run out. Women, we're not going to be charged more just because we're women. Those are protections that are across the board beneficial for everyone.
Well, there's a great deal of promise in a new program that seeks to sign up millions of people for insurance. And there's a lot of risk, too, in a program that is a patchwork of different programs in different states around the country. And in the very short term, Myra Alvarez, let's hope they get that bug at the website ironed out on the very last day of enrollment.
We have been getting it fixed, and it should be up and running now.
Myra Alvarez, Associate Director of the Office of Minority Health at HHS. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
We are officially in the Elite Eight of our TV SmackDown competition. Let me bring you up to speed now. After our Sweet 16, here's who's left. We have Archie Bunker from All in the Family, Dowager Countess from Downton Abbey, and our two matches from over the weekend, Lucy Ricardo, who beat Sybil Fawlty by a big landslide, and Agent Dale Cooper from Twin Peaks won in a squeaker over Omar from The Wire. That's a pretty big upset. And of course, we have our round two action today. It's Data from Star Trek going head-to-head with Tony Soprano, and Mary Richards takes on Liz Lemon. The men's side goes first, so here we go.
What makes Tony Soprano a better character than Data? The answer is obvious. James Gandolfini.
Don't call me Godfather with that f***ing cute smirk.
Played by Brent Spiner, Lieutenant Commander Data operated on the fringes of humanity. And we get it. That's cool and introspective.
Yes, that is it.
But Data is a machine, an android. And in watching him, you know he's a fictional character on a fictional spaceship defending a fictional federation of planets.
Did you damage your face, Data?
It is a beard, Geordi. A fine, full, dignified beard.
When Tony Soprano took his weekly seat in front of Dr. Melfi, it became less clear where Gandolfini ended and Soprano began.
Obviously, I'm prone to depression, a certain bleak attitude about the world. But I know I can handle it.
James Gandolfini and his character Tony were real and raw, and Data's got nothing on that.
Nowadays, everybody's got to go to shrinks and counselors and go on Sally, Jesse, Raphael and talk about their problems. Whatever happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type?
Have you forgotten Brent Spiner yet? Yeah, me too.
I hate this.
Vote for Tony Soprano, played by James Gandolfini in The Takeaway's TV Smackdown on thetakeaway.org.
Everyone loves a Cinderella story, and Data is the Takeaway TV Smackdown's Cinderella.
It has been quite a day.
He's already defeated one antihero, Don Draper. Now let's help our underdog Data take down the crime boss Tony Soprano.
Oh, shut up!
Don't get me wrong, I love Tony, but here's the thing. Truly great characters are supposed to hold a mirror up to us and help us explore our own humanity.
I am attempting to fill a silent moment with non-relevant conversation.
Small talk.
Yes, sir. How did I do?
Now, I've already made it clear that Data does this, but how does he do it better than Tony? Simple. Data doesn't need to be an anti-hero, living a life of crime in order to teach us lessons.
You don't like my values.
Honestly?
Yeah.
No.
Data is pure and good, and thus a greater all-around character. And let's not forget, he is in outer space, which is way cooler than New Jersey. No offense, Garden State.
What are you talking about?
Let's keep making it so. Don't vote for a character that gives you nightmares. Vote for Data.
Please.
A character that helps you dream.
That's Takeaway Associate Producer Ellen Frankman and Administrative Assistant Jolenta Greenberg making their cases there. Later this hour, Mary Richards and Liz Lemon go head-to-head. But remember, it's up to you to vote. Go to our website, thetakeaway.org, and cast your vote. And if you're disappointed that your favorite characters haven't made our brackets, and there are a lot of you, according to the comments on the website, we're opening this up for competition. This Friday, when we have our top two finalists from our brackets selected, we will add a wild card, a third contestant based on your comments. So go to our website and let us know which character you think absolutely needs to be on the list. Again, you can find the whole competition at thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick filling in for John Hockenberry today. Well, listen to this comment. Dear white people, we're not stupid. We know what satire is and what it isn't. I shouldn't have to interrupt my work and social life to respond to every act of racism. The left is just as complicit. I'm sick of liberals hiding behind assumed progressiveness. Now, that's a comment from 23-year-old social media activist Sui Park in a tweet aimed at Stephen Colbert, or at least Stephen Colbert's ultra-conservative persona, on the Colbert Report on Comedy Central. Last week, Stephen Colbert used a joke about race to make fun of racists. When the bit was on TV, no one seemed to take much notice. But when someone at the Colbert Report tweeted a joke from the bit using Asian stereotypes but without the rest of the context, hashtag activists on Twitter came out hard, creating the hashtag #CancelColbert. Our next guest spoke out against that hashtag and has spent the last few days being called many things on social media as a result. A lot of things we can't repeat, a couple, frankly, that I don't understand. He's Jeff Yang from The Wall Street Journal. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Jeff, recap for us and help us understand what has really gone on with the joke and since.
It's hard for me to unwind myself in many ways, but the beginning of all this was with the segment that Stephen Colbert did on his show, in which he attempted to essentially cast aspersion on the decision by Dan Snyder, owner of the Washington Redskins, to launch a nonprofit foundation called the Washington Redskins Original Americans Foundation, essentially as a way to disperse negative PR around the fact that the Redskins name is considered by many Native Americans to be an ethnic slur and a reminder of genocide and a lot of other bad things. So what Colbert did was he took a character that he has occasionally pulled out to essentially mock those who mock Asian accents, Ching Chong Ding Dong, and claimed that he was going to set up a foundation for sensitivity to Orientals or whatever. Now, within the context of a comedy segment with more nuance, you know, people can say that was simply advanced satire. But when you compress it to 140 characters, it doesn't sound so great.
And when it was on TV, let's remind ourselves that Stephen Colbert, doing what he often does, was actually echoing Rush Limbaugh, who has many times on his show and without irony referred to Asians with the Ching Chong or a Ding Dong or some kind of ethnically stupid angle like that. He was sort of doing Limbaugh.
Exactly. And the problem, of course, here is that you lose layers of nuance. You lose context when you take something and put it into a different medium, like, for instance, Twitter.
So then what happened once the hashtag Cancel Colbert took off? Suey Park originally tweeted Cancel Colbert. It took off. A lot of people, including yourself, I think, reacted against it, saying this hashtag assault lacks context. It doesn't appreciate satire. She said in the intro, which I read, I get satire. So where did Twitter leave us with this debate?
Twitter left us in a maelstrom. more people essentially got involved in various ways and chiming in on the nature of satire or the rectitude of using one minority perhaps to throw shade on the actions of racists or, you know, racialized comments towards another. And everybody ended up being pretty unhappy this weekend. It was a tough one, I must say. But I think the larger question for me was really the degree to which Asian Americans now have, as I put it in a column I wrote about it, weaponized the hashtag. We are, in many ways, the fastest finger. We've got a disproportionately large voice on digital media in general and social media in particular. And we can make things go viral. I think Suey Park has been incredibly capable of doing that in a wide range of causes, many of them very, very valid. The question, though, is what happens once you've unleashed the dynamite and set off the avalanche? Does that overwhelm all other voices? Does it make it so that it's impossible for any real conversation to happen?
And what I'm curious what you think what a weaponized hashtag really means in terms of activism. I saw this on Twitter, and there was some coverage of the activism on Twitter, and yet it's not the same kind of activism that drives somebody into the street or causes them to actually turn off a television show or boycott sponsors. It's really just clicking retweet. Now I'm an activist? What does it mean?
Well, I mean, activism can take a lot of different shades and shapes and sizes. And I think that what we see with hashtag activism, if you will, is that it's the activism of the follow. It's the activism of, you know, as you said, kind of this frictionless reshare. It's relatively easy, but it also has its own consequences. And some of those involve, in many cases, spreading information that can be without context. It can mean sometimes really brutally attacking bystanders or individuals who are in the line of fire in various ways. There is a component to this which is uncomfortable. I mean, I felt something myself, as have other people, that said, hey, maybe we should talk about this in a more nuanced fashion or more long-form medium, perhaps.
What did you think of the bit when it was on television?
I have to say, I mean, I, within the larger context of it, did not think it was particularly offensive. I think Colbert's satire is one that requires a longer view, if you will, to understand what he's trying to to kind of fully accomplish. And yet, I think the point was made, and I think this is an accurate one, something which J. Caspian Kang and the New Yorker and Sui Park herself ultimately shared. There is a sense in which the decision to use Asians as the sacrificial lamb, if you will, in order to attack the racism of the Redskins, you know, against Native Americans, is problematic. We are the easiest, in many ways, community to throw into the fire on these things because it seems like it doesn't have a lot of consequences. And I think that we've reached the era of consequences.
And several people have referred to the Asian community in this way sort of as the path of least resistance. Well, now everybody's aware of it. Jeff Yang writes the Dow Jones column for The Wall Street Journal, who is elucidating us on the fact that the long view of satire is often very, very short when it reaches Twitter. Jeff Yang, thank you.
Thank you.
Later this hour, we'll continue our TV bracket challenge as the ladies face off with Liz Lemon. It's a Lemon Party. And Mary Tyler Moore, be sure to head over to thetakeaway.org and vote for who you think is the greatest television character of all time. While you're there, you know, you can put in your votes for people that we may have forgotten. Lots of people are all over the website saying, how come Walter White isn't on there or Captain Kirk? Now's your chance. Get on the website at thetakeaway.org. You can always call us with your favorites at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
Let's go now from a fight that took place on Twitter to a country that tried to ban Twitter in the run-up to elections over the weekend. Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Erdogan has good reason to smile today after claiming victory for his party in municipal elections. It was a vote that was widely regarded as a referendum on his leadership. Erdogan has been seen as a favorite of Washington. He's got the ear of President Obama. In turn, the administration sees him as a crucial link between Europe and the predominantly Muslim Middle East. That's a traditional role for Turkey, of course. But his crackdown on local protests and strident attacks against his liberal opposition is causing growing concern in Washington about the direction of that country. Joining us is Zeynep Tufekci, professor at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Hello, Zeynep.
Hello.
Professor, thanks for joining us. You know, I'm interested in why so many people in the American government have such a close eye on a municipal election in Turkey. Why is it so important?
Well, what has happened is Turkey's undergone a couple of crises that shook the government in the past year. It started with the Gezi protests, which led to, you know, multi-day clashes in the middle of the biggest city in Turkey. And then a few months later, in December, massive allegations of corruption broke out. The government basically squashed the case through recordings and wiretaps that were allegedly of the prime minister and his closest allies that were released on social media. So both of those, either one of those would have tested any government. Both of those coming in the same year have thoroughly tested this government.
There was a massive reorganization of the government, a subjugation of the judiciary by Erdogan's government. He famously is trying to ban Twitter in that country because it says nasty things about him. Is this the kind of democratic leader that Washington can continue to support, do you think?
Well, he is elected, and he was elected for the third time last time around. And I think what has happened is some of the concerns that you outline had been voiced by people in Turkey, but there was sort of this strong desire for a model country that was an Islamist country, Islamic country, an Islamist sort of democratic leader. So there was a lot of fawning over Erdogan and perhaps looking over all these issues that had been voiced by people in Turkey. And now it seems to have completely sort of swung to the other side, and it looks like the world is only seeing all the problems with the country. I would say overall, this kind of shows that even Muslim countries have mundane political crises in some way. You know, the governments are corrupt and then people don't like it and the governments don't like being criticized. And on it goes. So while there is a crisis of unique nature, I don't think it's as big a swing sometimes as people make it out to be.
Well, before we let you go, we should remind ourselves that this was a municipal election, not a national election, but that Erdogan's party was running in all of these different municipalities. So a plurality of 43 or 44%, I think he got. What does that say about the strength of his leadership in Turkey?
Well, it says he has a base that is sticking by him. But remember, this happened under conditions of pretty strong control over mass media, a very strong crackdown on the judiciary, banning of alternative sources of news like Twitter and YouTube, and Erdogan basically going out all out and calling his opponents terrorists and traitors. So on the one hand, it looks like strength, and it is. He has a base that he keeps for understandable reasons. But it's also a fragility that it took this much to keep his base, which is actually quite loyal to him, and his policies have served well. Given that 55% of the country is feeling wary and scared, I think it signals a lot of turbulence ahead, whether the opposition can have a meaningful attempt at challenging him or whether the country sort of faces this polarized situation for longer.
Zeynep Tufekci, professor at the University of North Carolina, helping us watch the municipal elections in Turkey. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
This week, the Retro Report team looks back at coverage of sex abuse scandals in the Catholic Church. It was back in 1985. One of the very cases that got national attention, reports surfaced that Reverend Gilbert Gote of Henry, Louisiana, was abusing children and that his supervisors knew about it and had done nothing.
39-year-old Father Gilbert Gote has admitted that he sexually abused at least 35 boys. In sworn statements, the head of the local diocese, Bishop Jared Fry, has admitted learning about a child molestation involving Father Gote 10 years ago.
Now, the case caught the attention of a woman named Barbara Blaine, who had been abused when she was younger by her parish priest. At age 29, Blaine finally reported the abuse, but she found her attempts at getting justice also blocked.
Those church officials were clearly not helping. They were only making matters worse for me. And so I thought, I'll just find some other victims. We can research this and educate ourselves, and we'll figure this out.
But even as reports of abuse piled up, criminal investigations focus on priests who had committed the abuse and not the bishops who covered it up for them for so many years. Harry Hanbury is Retro Report producer and joins me now. Hi, Harry.
Hi.
Your decision to focus specifically on the bishops, was this because of what I just said, that so many people had all of the outrage about the priests, but not necessarily their enablers?
Exactly. I think one of the things that really struck me going back, looking at all these cases back to the Gote case, was that from that very first case in 1985, the first case to get major media attention, this was not just about crime, but about cover-up by the bishops. And we saw that in case after case after case until the crisis climaxed in 2002 with revelations in Boston and a major new push to reform.
Barbara Blaine started a group called SNAP, and she says in your Retro Report that it was the television talk shows, Oprah and Donahue, that really launched the campaign and kept it in front of the eyes of the public.
That's right. They made sure that after each show, the producers would put up a number where people could contact them. And after every show, she says, they would get dozens or hundreds of responses from victims around the country. By the way, they started to call themselves survivors, not victims. And by 2002, SNAP had 4,000 members.
So looking back then, as you looked at the attempt to bring responsibility to the enablers, the bishops, the ones responsible for moving priests around to different parishes or ignoring letters of complaint or covering up documents in many cases, what does the picture of responsibility or accountability look like for bishops now? Mm-hmm. I guess I'm wondering if anyone's gone to jail.
No one has gone to jail. The one case of a bishop who has been convicted in a criminal court is Bishop Robert Finn of Kansas City. He was found guilty in 2012 of failing to report suspected child abuse in the case of a priest, Father Sean Radigan, who had taken hundreds of pornographic photos of young girls. And this case really outrages victims because Radigan was sentenced to 50 years in prison. Bishop Finn remains bishop in Kansas City today.
Remains bishop.
Yeah.
And there have to be many, many other bishops who would have been caught up in questions of accountability who have not faced any.
Right. In 2002, actually, the very morning that many of the bishops were arriving in Dallas, where they had their big convention and met to consider a major package of reforms, on that morning, the Dallas Morning News ran a story in which they said that after a three-month investigation, two-thirds of bishops in the country had allowed priests accused of abuse to remain in their jobs. So that was a real bombshell and really turned up the heat on bishops. And since then, certainly none of those bishops have been disciplined by the Vatican. The one exception would be Cardinal Bernard Law of Boston, and he's in some ways the exception who proves the rule, because he went on to preside over one of the most magnificent churches in Rome, this giant ancient basilica, and continued to sit on powerful Vatican committees called congregations, including ones that select bishops and handle cases of sexual abuse.
And indeed, to this day, Bernard Law remains safely ensconced in an apartment in the sovereign country of the Vatican, out of reach of American law enforcement.
That's right. He's in his 80s now. He's retired, retired in 2011, but has continued to be a very prominent and important figure in the church.
And there he will remain. Harry Hanbury of Retro Report, producer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can find a link to the Retro Report on our website, thetakeaway.org. Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick filling in for John Hockenberry today. Well, today the national debt held by the public, held by all of us, is more than $17 trillion. And it's the subject of a lot of political fights. I don't have to tell you that. But here's a question. Should we even be worried about the debt, or is it just another case of political artifice? Listen.
We could reduce debt with higher taxes or by cutting benefits, but that would take money out of people's pockets. It means fewer jobs. It means lower incomes. So trying to reduce debt might actually make the debt situation worse. So let's think of something else to worry about. Debt just isn't a problem right now.
Well, that is Vox Media executive editor Matt Iglesias, a colleague of mine in Washington. In a controversial recent video all over the internet, he's making the case that much of the attention put on reducing the national debt is a waste of time because, as you heard him say, it's not really a problem right now. Well, former Houston Mayor Bill White, for one, would absolutely disagree with Matt Iglesias. White is author of a new book about U.S. debt. It's called America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse. And he argues that since 2001, a lack of fiscal discipline has launched American debt into reckless new terrain. And he's here in the studio with me. Bill White, welcome.
It's great to be with you.
It's good to have you, and I will give you the chance to react to that cut from Vox Media's Matt Iglesias right there. And really the point that he's making is that, yes, the number $17 trillion is gigantic, and yes, we all know that debt is bad. But he says debt is only bad if you have inflation and if interest rates go up. Inflation's low, interest rates are low, debt's not a big deal. The numbers prove it.
Well, that ignores having to repay the debt. The fact is that the amount of interest that we're going to pay on the federal debt is expected to double in the next 6 years. That's one reason why in the president's budget, who's not accused of being a right-winger, right? The amount that is invested in domestic programs aside from medical services is going down. It's why there's going to be fewer options for giving any tax relief if you're on the right and you want that. So this is for 90% of American history. The elected officials in both parties and the voters understood that if you incurred debt now, you would have to pay it back later with interest, with taxes, and they wanted to preserve the future for their kids. Put another way, if a benefit is worth having today, then why not ask the people to pay for it? And if people are unwilling to pay for it, then what does that tell you about whether or not we should have that benefit?
One of the things you rail against in this book is something that's rife in the Congress that I cover. It's assuming savings long into the future for spending now. For instance, we've been talking on the show about the Medicare doc fix when a bunch of politicians said, you know what we'll do? We'll cut doctors way in 2014. This was back in 1997. And we'll just move the money up forward so we can spend now.
Exactly.
Now, this is something that you really want to get sober about in this book.
Yeah, I mean, one of the first principles of good budgets that was established in the Jefferson administration is clear accounting. He said so that any merchant could look at the country's books. And it's out and out fraud to say that Well, as did the sort of surprise vote in the House last Thursday that they tried to do without C-SPAN cameras on, mm-hmm. a voice vote so we wouldn't have a record.
Darn right.
That they were going to fix, that they were going to basically vote to incur more debt in order to prevent this the physician's fees from being cut, which in itself was reasonable. But they didn't really have a way to offset that cost in the near term. So they projected that in 10 years we're going to cut Medicare again. That is out-and-out fraud. If somebody is going to vote to spend money that they're going to incur debt to pay for, they might as well admit it. And whenever somebody does something and then tries to hide it in politics, you know that something has gone wrong.
Now, one of the points that Matt Iglesias makes, and a lot of other people make too, is that rich people, rich countries, should borrow. Owing a lot of money on your house, for instance, doesn't mean that you're underwater. It means you're a wealthy person who can afford to pay debt service on your mortgage.
Right. And but let's extend that analogy out. You could borrow, and the country's borrowed, and cities and states borrow for long life capital improvements. That could be acceptable. But when you do that, you borrow an amount based in relationship to your relative income. The amount of total revenues that the federal government collects that are available for debt service are only 1/9 of the amount of total debt. So just bear with me here. Suppose you took a house mortgage that was 9 times greater than your annual income. Would that be prudent? No.
Right. And that's an analogy you're extending. Now, one thing I want to get to before we let you go, Bill White, is a very interesting sort of grand premise of this book, which is when we decide what to spend in this country. We have taxes, of course. We debate about the tax amount of revenue. Spending in this country is really about two things and two things only. Yeah. It's about our world domination, our military posture, and it's about Medicare, and really not much else.
Yeah, those are going to be the big drivers. And hard choices are going to have to be made. We disarm ourselves if we disarm national credit by using credit during times of peace, because there may be times where we need it in the future. People understood this for most of American history. And we have to address how to deal with the medical bills of 75 million baby boomers who will become eligible for Medicare between 2010 and 2030. And if folks look at my book, America's Fiscal Constitution, I'm not setting out that I have the perfect answer for these, but I do set forth the various alternatives where you would balance the budget for national security, balance the budget for Medicare. If that's what folks are interested in, then I've written a book about it.
It's a book that's rich in history about where we went wrong, in your view, and anybody who's interested in the fiscal view of the founding fathers would find it interesting. But also anybody who's interested in the real trade-offs that hopefully will come to drive our politics, at least in a sober way, will be interested in America's Fiscal Constitution, its triumph, and its collapse, by Bill White. Bill, thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
Well, college basketball is down to UConn, Florida, Wisconsin, and Kentucky. The teams are making their way down to Arlington, Texas for the Final Four. And your votes at thetakeaway.org are quickly narrowing our field of greatest TV characters of all time. But that doesn't mean you have to agree with the candidates. Kales Hoffman from Wichita Falls says, okay, you guys have never seen Seinfeld. George Costanza is not only the best character on that show, but the best character in television history. Don't worry, Kales. Elaine Bennis lost last week to the Dowager Countess from Downton Abbey. Well, we want you to go on the website because we're giving you the opportunity to put your wild cards into our contest. Somebody that we forgot? Go to thetakeaway.org. You can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Space is closer than you think. Listen.
Yeah, that's really high. How small you are. I'm going
over. You recognize that slightly garbled voice? That's Felix Baumgartner right before his jump from a balloon 24 miles above the Earth's surface in October of 2012. Well, now, by the end of 2016, a private company called Worldview plans to bring tourists, you and me, to the brink of outer space in a high-altitude balloon, not unlike the one that Felix Baumgartner jumped from in 2012. Just shy of the height that he reached, by the way, a couple of miles below, passengers will be able to travel to 19 miles above the ground to see the curvature of the Earth and the blackness of space for the mere cost of $75,000. Right, Jane Poynter?
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah, and I hope you'll join us.
Jane
I want to go, that's for sure.
Jane Poynter, you are CEO of Worldview, which I just mentioned. So for 75 grand up in a balloon to 19 miles, of course, nobody's jumping out. It's just to look out the windows.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I suppose if you really wanted to, we could figure out how to orchestrate that, but that's not the general plan. The general plan is that what we're trying to do is actually make space more accessible than most of us have ever thought it possible to be. And by that, we want it to be comfortable. We want you to be able to sit in this really comfy capsule without a spacesuit, no training, no medical requirements, maybe even your beverage of choice, as you look outside the window at this extraordinary display of the planet below you.
What kind of pre-flight or pre-rise training is required? Just enough to sit in a comfy chair with a drink?
Little bit of a safety briefing, sort of on akin to probably a little more in depth, but akin to what you would get when you get on a plane. So certainly not a week of training or months of training if you were going to go into orbit.
Now you are providing. Now you're not the first to do this. There's Virgin Galactic, a couple of other companies that are engaging in space tourism, but you're providing a little bit of price pressure on the other guys because, dare I say, 75 grand is kind of cheap in the space tourism business.
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to make this accessible in every way, right? I mean, you know, $75,000 still, you know, is not cheap, but it's certainly a lot less than if you were to jump on a rocket and head to space. You know, we're really wanting to make this as affordable as we can, and over time, we have plans to bring it down. Certainly won't be, you know, tomorrow. But over a number of years, we hope to bring it down.
Can we talk about the physics of the flight? It's easy to understand hot air and going up to 19 miles looking around. Then the descent, a balloon is vulnerable to the jet stream and all the other streams and all the forces and the winds and the air currents. Do you guarantee where one lands?
Yeah, it's actually really kind of cool. So you go up, as you say, under the balloon, and also think about it in a way to think about it is almost like an ice cube sitting on a glass of water. The balloon is floating on top of the atmosphere. So now you're going along with the winds. And when you start coming back down, you actually come down under a parawing, which is effectively a parachute that you can steer. And the parawing is open the entire time from the launch through landing. So you can glide back down to the Earth at any time. And, of course, we have predetermined landing sites. So these parafoils, the parawing, you can actually steer it down to the landing site of your choice.
Fully steerable. And how does one get certified as a parawing pilot? Are they members of the airline pilots union?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Actually, Mark Kelly is our director of flight crew operations, so he'll be the one, astronaut Mark Kelly, who I'm sure you're familiar with. He'll be the one who will be setting up exactly who we're going to hire and the training for that. So I think that's a little bit TBD, but I'm sure it's going to be incredibly qualified people with a lot of parafoil experience and just a probably enormous amount of flight experience, that's for sure. And Mark himself he's a test pilot.
Yes, two-time astronaut on the space shuttle and husband of Gabby Giffords, the congresswoman. Well, for the mere cost of $75,000, Jane Poynter says that you can get on one of her balloons on Worldview and go to 19 miles above the Earth and glide safely back down. Jane, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the basketball brackets continue on the court in the NCAA tournament, but our own pop culture brackets continue here on The Takeaway, where TV characters have been going head-to-head for the last couple of weeks here. Entering the arena now is Mary Richards from The Mary Tyler Moore Show and Liz Lemon of 30 Rock, two female characters who are actually very similar, just separated by about 30 years.
I know a lot of you folks out there love Liz Lemon, and why shouldn't you? After all, she's more or less a modern copycat of Mary Richards. You know Mary Richards, the smart TV producer.
We need an angle.
I had an idea.
The voice of reason in a cast of crazy characters.
I don't know, Mary, I just don't believe a real nun would carry a whip.
And, of course, Mary has her romantic ups and downs.
I mean, you know, who cares about three dumb little words anyway? You want to hear it. God, do I ever.
She comes from a family that's as messed up as all of our families.
About the only time I ever saw my father display any affection in public was when he patted our dog. Even then, you had the feeling the poor dog was embarrassed.
And sometimes Mary just loses her cool.
But you shut up, Ted!
In short, Mary's like all of us. Flawed, but trying her best. In today's world, where we have an abundance of Mary-like characters, it might be easy to forget that, before Mary Richards, there wasn't anyone quite like us on TV.
I don't know why.
Mary didn't just change entertainment. She changed the national conversation. I love Liz Lemon. But can Liz Lemon say that?
I'll admit it. I'm a sucker for Mary Richards.
You got spunk.
Well,
I hate spunk.
There probably wouldn't be a Liz Lemon without Mary Richards.
I'll just pour myself a drink.
Mary was a trailblazer. But as much as I love Mary, I don't know anyone like her. And she's really an idealized version of the single gal in the big city.
Mary Richards, the best-looking thing to ever hit Minneapolis news.
But we can all see aspects of ourselves in Tina Fey's Liz Lemon.
Hey, nerds! Guess who's got two thumbs, speaks limited French, and hasn't cried once today, this moi.
In her difficult friendships, her frustrating family, and her terrible dates.
No, what is this?
Dr. Drew's Salmon Bourguignon.
What is this orangey taste?
Gatorade.
Mary Richards may have broken down some barriers, but Liz Lemon is truly a revelation.
And you'll all see that I'm fun.
That's Movie Date co-host Kristen Meinzer and Takeaway associate producer Jillian Weinberger defending Mary Richards and Liz Lemon in our Elite Eight. But it's up to you now to cast your vote. Go to our website at thetakeaway.org to cast your vote in that latest matchup. And if you're like Ray from New York and disappointed that we missed Claire Huxtable, or Sabrina, who's furious that Kramer from Seinfeld didn't make the list, there you go, we have a bit of good news for you. We're opening up the competition this Friday. When we have the top two finalists from our brackets selected, we will add a wild card, a third contestant, based on your comments. And there have been a lot of them on the website about people who you thought should have been included but were overlooked. So go to that website. Let us know which character you think absolutely has to be on the list. Again, you can find the whole competition at thetakeaway.org. And remember, it's up to you to cast your vote. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. More at 1-800-REPUTATION or at Reputation.com. The Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.